VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the battle tightens over the Iraqi city of Ramadi. Security concerns drive the U.S. presidential race. Geneva makes a push to become the global peace capital.
As the world continues to be fragmented, Geneva becomes more and more a place of choice because of its neutrality, because of its reputation as a place where you can do the business of peace without other agendas interfering.
And joy comes to the movies. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Iraqi security forces, aided by U.S.-led coalition airstrikes and Sunni tribesmen, are closing in on the center of Anbar's provincial capital of Ramadi, about 100 kilometers west of Baghdad, in a weeks-long offensive to retake it from Islamic State fighters. They captured the city 7 months ago. Several hundred IS fighters are believed to have barricaded themselves in the city center. U.S. Army Colonel Steve Warren, an Operation Inherent Resolve spokesman, briefed reporters on the fight, saying an IS defeat is now inevitable.
We're encouraged by this tactical development, which is a continuation of the progress we've seen over the last several weeks. There's still a long way to go before we can declare Ramadi is completely clear. There is a lot of dense terrain here that needs to be negotiated. Booby traps, IEDs, the presence of enemy fighters who are fighting fairly hard. The numbers aren't really high, I wouldn't say, but it's not very easy to maneuver through that terrain. And so it doesn't take much in the way of defensive capability to hold, you know, the attackers back. Well, as the air power intensifies, as the Iraqi security forces draw closer in, as the pressure builds, it stands to reason that the civilian population will soon realize that the end is near and be a little bit less fearful of ISIL's ability to hold them.
Ramadi's civilian population is believed to number between 4,000 and 10,000, who are, for the most part, trapped. A local journalist claims Islamic State fighters are using civilians as human shields. James Jeffrey is a former ambassador to Baghdad and is now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He told International Edition's Victor Beatty, while the Islamic State fighters are relatively small in number, they have had months to dig in and will be difficult to dislodge.
We've seen this on many fronts. You need overwhelming forces, American airstrikes, and an awful lot of time. And, of course, what we've talked about before is I'm not so sure time is on our side.
Meaning what, sir?
A, ISIS's ability to launch terrorist attacks. B, ISIS's control of much of Iraq and Syria. C, the impact of that on the Syrian civil war. D, the possibility, if we're not careful, that this will slip out of control into a Sunni-Shia war. And E, the fact that ISIS's continued presence is giving Putin the excuse to intervene massively all over the region, doing almost everything to expand his power and reduce ours, while doing very little against his ostensible goal, degrading ISIS.
Does that lend more credence to the significance of a victory in Ramadi?
Victory in Ramadi is a good thing. We need more of them. I think that in other cities, particularly in Mosul, in Raqqa, and parts of eastern Syria, we'll find that these people fight even harder with more forces. One thing of note is, while Shia militias were not involved, a fair number of Sunni Arabs have been involved in the fighting in Ramadi and elsewhere in Anbar. There we have the largest concentration of Sunni Arabs who are fighting with the Iraqi government and with us against ISIS. That may not be the case in other areas.
Are U.S. forces at all involved directly or indirectly?
Well, they're involved, first of all, in the airstrikes, secondly, in planning and coordinating missions. They're not as involved as I would like them to be. They're not as involved as Secretary Carter wants them to be because the Iraqis did not, as far as I can see, accept his idea to use Apache helicopters and perhaps to move troops closer to the front.
Is that because Baghdad is somewhat beholden to Iran and wants to keep on good relations with Tehran?
To some degree, but another degree is Baghdad knew that it was probably going to win this thing and felt that it would not have as much criticism from Iran and from the Shia militias and Shia members of parliament if it could do it on its own rather than a lot of very ostentatious help by the United States. The problem is Ramadi is one battle of many, and in other areas there's going to be more need for us to be more active.
Former U.S. diplomat to Baghdad James Jeffrey talking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. The recapture of Ramadi would be the second major urban area taken from the Islamic State group this year after Tikrit fell to Iraqi security forces in April. But the IS group continues to hold Fallujah, Tal Afar, and Mosul. Meanwhile, a report released Wednesday by rights group Amnesty International says Russia's air campaign in Syria killed hundreds of civilians and caused massive destruction in residential areas. The rights group claims the pattern of Russian attacks show evidence of violations of international law. There is reaction to that on social media, as we hear Olin Akisulu tell International Edition colleague Michael Lippin.
Amnesty International has been very active in trying to get this report shared on social media already, and it's been tweeting out different facts from the report using Twitter handles like @AmnestyPress and @AmnestyOnline. And Anya Neistat, she's the senior director for research at Amnesty International, she tweeted a link to an interactive map showing the location of Russian airstrikes in Syria and some reports on casualties and the damage caused in each strike. For people that are interested in reading the full report, they can actually go online and read the whole document. It's being hosted on Amnesty International's website, and different Amnesty International Twitter handles have been tweeting out links to make it easy to find.
Well, how have social media users been reacting to this report?
Well, oftentimes the Russian Foreign Ministry tweets a response when Russia becomes the focus of international news like this, but that hasn't been the case with this latest Amnesty International report. So far, people have been tweeting the different facts shared by Amnesty International, retweeting rather, but looking at how people are responding to the report on Twitter, Amnesty International Online, they tweeted out a link to the report from the handle @AmnestyOnline, and people who responded to the tweet were mostly people saying that the report singles out Russia and saying Turkey is also responsible for human rights abuses in Syria, specifically against Kurdish fighters. But the report is still hitting social media. The response may change as it starts to get more attention from Twitter users.
VOA's Olin Akisulu. You can tweet us your feedback at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations, VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. Public opinion polls show American voters regard terrorism and national security as the top issues in the 2016 presidential election campaign, in the wake of the recent terror attacks in Paris and San Bernardino, California. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on how the White House contenders from both major political parties are adapting to the shift in emphasis as the campaign heats up.
Donald Trump remains the dominant figure in the Republican presidential race, and recent polls show Republican voters rate him higher than any of his rivals on dealing with terrorism.
This isn't going to be an election on niceness anymore, even if I wasn't nice. This is going to be an election on competence and smartness and toughness, because otherwise our country is finished. It's finished.
At the latest Republican debate, rival Jeb Bush questioned whether Trump was ready to lead.
If I'm president, I'll be a commander-in-chief, not an agitator-in-chief or a divider-in-chief, that I will lead this country in a way that will create greater security and greater safety.
Experts thought the focus on security would help establishment contenders like Bush, but it's not worked out that way, says analyst Stuart Rothenberg.
A foreign policy crisis or an environment focused on defense, national security, would help candidates with some stature, with some experience on foreign policy and national security issues. So far, the early indications are it has helped the kind of loudest, blustery candidate, that would be Donald Trump.
The emphasis on security may have also helped Democratic contender Hillary Clinton widen her lead over rival Bernie Sanders. Clinton wants to intensify the military campaign against Islamic State fighters, but is questioning the strategy of some of the Republican candidates.
Promising to carpet bomb until the desert glows doesn't make you sound strong. It makes you sound like you're in over your head.
During the latest Democratic debate, Bernie Sanders acknowledged the threat posed by the Islamic State, but warned against repeating past mistakes.
The United States must lead, but the United States is not the policeman of the world. The United States must not be involved in perpetual warfare in the Middle East.
The focus on terrorism and security could help Clinton in the Democratic primaries, but she may need to separate herself from President Barack Obama in the general election, says John Fortier.
The president's numbers have really gone down on foreign policy. He is seen especially on terrorism, but broadly on foreign policy as being weaker. It hasn't hurt his overall numbers, but there is some traction for Republicans to gain.
The first real test for all the presidential contenders will come in early February in Iowa and New Hampshire. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
The Swiss city of Geneva may be on course to reemerge as the peace capital of the world next year. It is a position Geneva held in the final two decades of the 20th century. Lisa Schlein has details.
In the 1980s, Geneva was abuzz with U.S.-Soviet bilateral nuclear arms control talks. The city hosted U.S. President Ronald Reagan and his Soviet counterpart Mikhail Gorbachev. Other peace activities included efforts to bring long-running wars in Afghanistan and Lebanon to an end. The collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989 hastened the breakup of the former Republic of Yugoslavia and triggered the start of the Balkan Wars. UN-mediated peace talks aimed at resolving the wars became an ongoing feature throughout the 1990s. The Director General of the UN Office in Geneva, Michael Moller, does not think those days are likely to return. But he believes Geneva and the United Nations will play an increasingly prominent role as a center for peace in the coming year. He says another round of peace talks on Yemen will begin January 14th. He says this will be followed by Syrian peace negotiations toward the end of January. In the meantime, he says UN Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura is traveling widely and establishing contact with the relevant parties.
Everybody is on board, almost everybody. Wants these talks to be successful so that we can finally get a political solution to this really unacceptable problem.
The United Nations hosted two rounds of Syrian peace talks in 2014. Both ended in failure. Last week, the Security Council approved a diplomatic roadmap making it possible for talks to resume. Moller says Geneva and the United Nations continue to be the hub for peace negotiations and conflict resolution.
As the world continues to be fragmented, Geneva becomes more and more a place of choice because of its neutrality, because of its reputation as a place where you can do the business of peace without other agendas interfering.
Moller notes the United Nations this year hosted around 10,000 meetings and conferences. They included four mediation processes and multiple rounds of negotiations at UN headquarters and other venues in Geneva and Switzerland. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Billions of dollars are spent every year on developing drugs to treat a host of illnesses. U.S. researchers have come up with a strategy they hope will motivate pharmaceutical companies to direct their drugs where they will have the greatest impact. VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
It's called the Global Health Impact Index, and it's a simple way to track the places in the world where vital drugs can have the biggest impact. It was created by researchers at Binghamton University in New York and will soon be launched by the World Health Organization. The Web Index, described in the journal PLOS ONE, is designed to identify companies that are doing the most to improve global health and those that are doing the least. Binghamton philosophy professor Nicole Hassoun helped create the web tool.
So how do we evaluate each drug? So basically what we do is we look at three things. We look at the need for the drug, how effective it is, and how many people who need the drug can access it.
Hassoun says about one-third of deaths globally are linked to poverty-related diseases.
Millions of people die every year from these easily preventable poverty-related diseases, things like malaria and tuberculosis and HIV. And so if we can incentivize greater access to essential medicines, that could make a really big difference for people who are suffering around the world.
The index identifies three companies whose drugs are having the biggest impact on the three diseases. They include Sanofi, Novartis, and Pfizer. The website tracks donations and companies that provide drugs at reduced or little cost to the world's poorest individuals. Hassoun says that helps visitors see which companies are making drugs available to the world's most impoverished people.
You see the total impact we're having on these different diseases with these medicines. It's simple and easy to understand, and you can see in a transparent way where we're having an impact and where we need to have a greater impact on global health.
By identifying the companies that are most responsive to the needs of poor individuals, Hassoun hopes drug manufacturers that are not doing as well in providing affordable medications will be motivated to follow suit. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Still to come, joy comes to the movies. This is VOA.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
This is VOA's International Edition. Children often do not understand other children with disabilities. It can leave them frightened and even lead to bullying. Anya Dameron, author of the book Super Kids, has some suggestions on how to communicate to young ones about those with disabilities. And she shares them with International Edition's Susan Yockey.
I think that teaching your children about disabilities can be a huge challenge. It needs to be done in a way that the children can comprehend and doesn't feel awkward. It really needs to be done in a fun but educational way. That's why we created this book. We were trying to make it easier to talk about disabilities because we as parents, teachers, uncles, grandmas, it's very hard to talk about this with kids. It's like an awkward moment. And trying to make it normal, I think it's the best. Trying to teach them that we're not the same. Everyone is unique, that we all have differences, that we all have weaknesses, and pointing them to what's positive about everyone else, I think it's the best way.
Could you give us a tip on one way to help accomplish this?
I think that we could start by showing the kids all the things that disability children or people do that we don't. All the things they can do, the positive things that they develop, that they learn to be able to be around us. Like, for example, a girl that can speak with her hands or a boy that can read with his hands. Stuff like that can make them curious and can change the way they see disability people.
And what age should you start talking to your children about other children with disabilities?
I think that you can start, like, since they're very little. Like, we just made a picture book about it. From 3 years old, you can start reading it to them. And the sooner the better, because then it's normal for them to talk about that.
That's Anya Dameron, author of the book called Super Kids, speaking with International Edition Susan Yockey. What began as a farmer decorating his home with lights more than 60 years ago turned into a seasonal Christmas village for visitors. The Kosher family's Christmas village in rural Pennsylvania is a charming attraction with dazzling lights and old-fashioned toys. VOA's Deborah Block walked around the more than 1 million lights in the U.S. Northeast community of Burnville, Pennsylvania.
During the holiday season, this one-time dairy farm becomes a make-believe Christmas village. It began in 1948 when William Kosher decorated his family's 19th-century house with Christmas lights and decorations.
And people just heard about it, saw it just locally, and then they spread the word, and they just started to come and line up on the hill, and they would wait for the lights to go on.
Then, says Beverly Kosher, her father put lights on the barn.
He decorated the big silo, and he would put things in the windows here in the barn, and at the same time, we still had 40 cows being milked.
Each year, he added more light displays, and then small village buildings. The farm became a seasonal paid attraction.
He just really, really enjoyed people coming and telling him how it made the Christmas season so much more meaningful to them.
After her father died about 30 years ago, Beverly Kosher and other family members kept the Christmas village alive.
There are lots of our toys. We have my mother's china.
Hundreds of thousands of people visit during the 2 months. It is open during the holiday season. Kosher says this bell and wishing well have been on the farm since she was a little girl.
And everybody comes here, rings the bell, throws their money in, and it goes to charity.
Some people came when they were a child. Now they bring their own children, who also enjoy the displays. Even the Christmas Village Santa says he looks forward to the dazzling lights.
They're so beautiful. It lights the whole valley up. And it just brings joy to so many people.
The Kosher children follow their father's tradition by adding new features, like this year's more modern Christmas tree light display. But Beverly Kosher says the idea is to keep the village much the way it used to be.
We keep it as nostalgic as we can. To this day, we still enjoy seeing people have so much fun here.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Burnville, Pennsylvania.
The joy of Christmas can also be enjoyed along with joy at the movie theater. Academy Award winner Jennifer Lawrence is in a new movie playing a woman who made her fortune by designing household products. And you guessed it, her name is Joy. And so is the name of the film. International Edition's David Byrd takes a look and a listen.
Christy, look at me. I want you to remember something. Because a lot of times people get nice things and they start to think differently. We got here from hard work, patience, and humility. So I want to tell you, don't ever think that the world owes you anything, because it doesn't. The world doesn't owe you a thing.
Jennifer Lawrence reunited with director David O. Russell and Bradley Cooper, her co-star in Silver Linings Playbook and American Hustle, to tell the story of Joy Mangano, a Long Island-born housewife who found fame and fortune by designing household products. Mangano, a divorced mother of three, developed the so-called Miracle Mop and in 1992 pitched it to the QVC television shopping network. It became an overnight success.
Hi, I'm Joy Mangano, and I invented the Miracle Mop. It's the original cotton self-wringing mop, therefore the most absorbent. It will clean that mess again and again and again. And
I'm Jennifer Lawrence says that she was inspired by Mangano's story and wanted to bring it to the screen.
There's so many impressive parts of her that she, and just about the story in general, about how kind of long it took her, to finally decide, I'm not going to let this dream go. I'm going to keep fighting for this, no matter who believes in me, no matter who doesn't, no matter how many people say no.
You got the exact same outfit you had when you came in here.
I wear a blouse and I wear pants. That's who I am. I want to go on as me.
I want to go on as you. I hope you make it back. Joan, Cindy, say good luck to Joy.
Wow.
You look great. Good luck today.
Oh, thank
good
you.
Luck.
That's her. That's how she is.
Blossom, she should be in a skirt. She's got nice long legs. Show her legs. Good luck.
Joan Rivers wants me in a skirt, but I'm going to do pants.
Bradley Cooper says he actually met Joy Mangano and he knew he wanted to make this film.
I was in the middle of doing a play, so then I knew that the real Joy was at the hotel I was staying at, so I went down and met her. So that's all I knew, it was based on a real thing. But I also was very aware of the Miracle Mop. I grew up using that mop because QVC was also a huge part of my upbringing.
Director David O. Russell, an Oscar nominee for his last two films with Lawrence and Cooper, says familiarity with his actors makes for a comfortable set where more chances are taken.
You have a comfort level with each other that just means you can take new chances. Jennifer is more quietly powerful in this film than I've seen her. She's not loud. She's doing something different that I find very interesting. Bradley as well. You know, they both watched them grow up in the last 5 years.
Jennifer Lawrence, who has been nominated for a Golden Globe for her performance in Joy, says that Russell makes it easy to take chances in front of the camera.
And it's so wonderful working with David, where I don't have to think about anything. If he gives me a note and it sounds absolutely insane, I just do it. It's a trust fall, and it's wonderful.
Joy also stars Oscar winner Robert De Niro as Joy Mangano's father, Rudy. Melissa Rivers stars as her mother, comedian and QVC host Joan Rivers, and actors Donna Mills and Susan Lucci portray themselves. The film opens December 25th in the United States. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, features, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
In a popular American short story, a young couple, poor but very much in love, frets over what to give each other for Christmas. To buy her husband Jim a chain for his proudest possession, a gold pocket watch, Della sells her proudest possession, her long brown hair, to be made into a wig. Jim finds Della a fine pair of hair combs, but he can pay for them only by trading away his watch. When they exchange gifts and realize what they've done, their now useless presents are all the more precious because of the love and sacrifice they represent. The holiday of Christmas, which millions of Americans and others around the world celebrate today, has inspired many such tales. Some deal with the lessons of generosity and hope, others with the value of friendship, family, and faith. Oddly, one of the most famous, A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, is essentially a ghost story. What they have in common is a spirit of redemption and rejoicing that has long touched the human heart. Tradition is as much a part of the holiday as is its spirit. As in much of the world, millions of Americans will exchange gifts, worship together in their various ways, then gather perhaps with family and friends to complete the celebration over dinner. Many will volunteer to help the homeless, hungry, and others in need. These sentiments transcend nationality, however, and even religion. As the world gets smaller, the Christmas spirit is seen in many places, from Europe to Africa and even Asia. In Japan, Christmas is known more as a time to spread happiness rather than as a religious celebration. Presents and cards are exchanged, and parties are often held for children, with games and dancing. In Madagascar, an island nation off the east coast of Africa, it's summer at Christmas time, but even though it's hot, many homes are decorated in the spirit of the season with holly and imitation snow, even though none of them exist there. The message of peace on earth and goodwill toward men is universal, and one that Americans wish to share at this time of year with all citizens of the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.